And welcome to Dawn of X Book Chat, where we discuss Dawn of X. The only problem with that is that there is no Dawn of X right now, and we are discussing past books that relate to Dawn of X in some tangential way, some more than others. My name is Fox.
I'm Rodders.
I'm Juan.
And I'm Amas. So there's a lot to talk about. This week we're talking about Necrotia, and it was over three different books. It was X-Force 2008, The New Mutants Volume 2, and X-Men Legacy. And I just want to say that the best part of Necrotia is the one that was a new X-Men. Because I've never understood the appeal of Douglock, but that scene where Morlock is trying to help Doug, and Doug is like, "I love you and you are breaking my heart," had me reeling for 3 days after I read that. I could not stop thinking about it. It was absolutely the best part of the Necrotia arc.
Oh yeah, definitely. When I read New Mutants Volume 2, I think a year ago, I didn't read the whole Necrotia arc then. I just read that part, and I didn't know it was with that. I didn't even know what Necrotia arc was, but I was like, oh yeah, I read this before. And when the first time I read it, I was like, man, this is some deep stuff right here. I didn't think he was that emotional, like the techno-organic alien. I didn't think he had the capability to be that emotional, because at that point I haven't read that much about him. I just thought he was like technology with damage to him. So it really put an impression on me about him.
I really liked this entire event. I really liked how you could read almost each of the separate books by them, like each of the separate, because you could read X-Force by itself, New Mutants by itself, or X-Men Legacy by itself, and it would all work as their own self-contained arc almost. But I really liked this event altogether. It's one of my favorite X-Men events I've ever read. I before this I'd only ever read the one shot that they used to set it up, and I really liked it. And also, that did anybody read that the what's it called, the Dazzler one shot that
Oh
was like
yeah,
an
the Dazzler
epilogue?
was so
I
good.
did. I loved it.
That moment with the mom, that just, oh, that touched me.
I liked it, and it was cool, but it was very inconsequential.
No, it was just basically ending the arc that they started with Allison Blair's sister and everything.
Yeah, it was just a Dazzler, just for Dazzler fans that just needed some more Dazzler content.
Thank God, because we don't ever get anything.
Right? There's not that
We all
much
need
there.
Dazzler content.
Boy.
Yeah, they definitely expanded her arc.
But,
Definitely.
What was, other than the Douglock moment, what was everybody's favorite moment from this event?
Cool. I think every moment with Celine basically is my favorite moment, because I've only seen her in the recent run of Captain America that I read a little bit. I haven't finished that, but I saw when she was introduced as the villain again in that. And I don't think I've read anything else of her. I can't remember. But I this is the first time I really got in depth with her, and obviously the whole arc was basically about her. And I loved every second. She was so had so much attitude, just had very I'm in charge, this is what I want, this is happening. I mean, and she basically almost succeeded. A lot of villains, I mean, we always get to that crucial point where the villain's about to win, but she basically almost won. If they didn't have that one thing that stopped her, the knife, then she would have conquered the whole world. She came that close, and that's pretty badass.
Thomas,
Go ahead.
I don't I see the Douglock moment was the best moment for me, because everything else was sort of inconsequential or not really my thing. Because a lot of it took place in X-Force 2008, and that's one of my least favorite series to read. Just because a lot of it is very Josh Foley heavy, and Josh Foley got me banned from Twitter, so I'm not a really big fan of most of the stuff that happened in X-Force. I do have to say, I kind of did like how they gave Jimmy the spotlight for a little while. And I did enjoy the scenes with, I forget if they're in Legacy. I think they're in X-Men Legacy where Ruth gets a vision from Destiny. I thought that was really cool. I really hope we get Ruth and I really hope that there's a follow-up to this eventually, because it's never sure as to why, if Destiny is really related to Ruth or not, just that, like, tangentially, somehow, they share some genetic material.
They never... It's funny how much it set up X-Men Legacy, because you know how it said that, you know, her mom died protecting her from her brother. That was not... That plot point was not picked up again until X-Men Legacy.
Really?
The Legion X-Men Legacy series? Nope, nice. not even picked up once. Her brother becomes one of the villains of the book.
I was wondering if that was got touched upon again. Because I was like, that's really interesting. I want to see more of that.
Yeah, that was not picked up until that series. I could be wrong, but I'm almost positive.
For me personally, like, jumping off of Almas's point, I actually liked Warpath's story on here. I've never been the biggest Warpath fan. This was one time where I was like, okay, I like this. I like what they're doing with him. They're using him in a pretty awesome way, you know, and having his brother be in there, having to deal with, you know, ancestral stuff. They made him a very big part of this story. He was a key component of it, which I really liked. And then this, it's so weird because I don't know if you guys saw that I'm rereading New X-Men, and the issue that I stopped at is actually right before Wither and Celine meet up. So it was so weird jumping into this story, because that's exactly where the story picks up. And I was like, oh, damn, like this flows into that. So it was cool reading all of Wither's arc in this and seeing how, like, how broken and how, like, he was just searching for someone to love him and someone to, like, accept him. And this whole arc was pretty cool, just to see him, like, hit his pinnacle villainous moment and then have his showdown with Elixir.
I really liked his fight with his brother, where his brother was like, stop me. He's like, I don't want to hurt you, but I can't not fight you. Don't do it. It was, and also really liked, Vanisher is such a terrible person. Vanisher is a really terrible character as a person. But, like, him constantly begging, like, Josh was like, hey, man, can you please take this thing out of my head, please?
Oh, my God.
Please get it. He's like, come on. He's like, we're all going to die anyways. Can you just please take the tumor out of my brain? And then
I love it. When he was like, dude, it's already gone. Shut up.
Yeah, sorry.
Go on.
I really liked how it kind of relates back to Hickman's theory on how mutants can't really control their nature. I like how Selene manipulated all the other, like, members with that, like, Blink and, like, Wither and all that. She came to them basically like, hey, your power is destructive, your destiny is to be destructive, come do this with me, feed into your hunger to want to, you know, destroy and murder. Yeah, give into your dark side that's already calling you, because this is your power, this is what you're supposed to be. And I like that, because even, like, that's their nature. It's kind of not their fault, because that is the power that they were given. You know, they're like, well, what else can I do with this power? My power literally drains the life of people. What else can I do with this except basically kill and just do whatever I want and be evil? And Selene giving them an out, making it seem like they're okay, finally made them feel at peace, even if it was, you know, horrible and killed a lot of people. But I like how it connects when you read these past stories. You see how writers are connecting from the past. They're like, hey, you know, a lot of mutants, we're doing all this on Krakoa. We're doing a clean slate for all the mutants, because a lot of them that were being so evil wasn't really their fault. even with they even if they did big events like this and killed so many people and did all this, they still allowed Selene to come on Krakoa and like Apocalypse and all the other villains, because it's in their nature, it's in their power is manipulating them. So they're like, well, this is how you are, we're gonna take you anyway. I like how it connects. I really like the connection of everything, even if like they're just making it up as they go along. I like how it all kind of comes back together.
I have a question for Almas. Oh wait, no, you already explained. It. You said you don't like X-Men. You don't like X-Force because it's elixir. It's so elixir heavy.
Okay. You can ask me the question. The expert to the question. I feel like you have more say.
Why don't you like elixir? He always just seemed like, oh, look at this kid. Okay, he's way OP.
So here's first and foremost, I am a Christopher Muse stan. I was introduced to Christopher Muse before Josh Foley. So, because I read Uncanny X-Men 2013, I think, first. And then I went back and read Academy X. In Academy X, there's like the scene where he joins the anti-mutant people. And everyone is like, what the hell? Why are you joining the anti-mutant people when you're a mutant, Elixir? And then he's like, well, kind of, well, it's like, I'm not like physically a mutant, blah, blah. And everyone gets mad at him, but like the book justifies him joining an anti-mutant group. So that was like my first impression of Josh Foley. And I don't really like him because of that. And like, you can say that like people change over comics, and I'm sure he does, but he's really annoying. And in a lot of the comics after that, he's written as like he's always trying to date like the three cuckoos all at once, which is very uncomfortable because they're sisters. And so like his entire character comes off as like jerky and arrogant rather than like someone who's OP and jerky and arrogant. He just comes off like sort of annoying. And just in general, like he's never brought someone back from like death like Christopher Muse, and I truly believe that Christopher Muse deserves the Omega Mutant title rather than Josh Foley. And
that's Triage, right? Triage,
yeah, Triage. And I just like, listen, there's so many better characters than Josh Foley out there. I can name like a multiple. Like even Julian Keller has like a more interesting inner conflict than Josh Foley. He's never had an interesting inner conflict or outer conflict because he's either a doormat or an asshole and nothing in between.
Fair enough. That was very interesting. Very explanatory. I just liked him because I just thought he was just a pretty boy. He's the one normal looking person on X-Force. By normal I mean he's like, you look at like all the other characters, you see like Domino.
He has book jaundice.
What?
No, sorry. He's read too many books and now he's orange. I'm sorry, that was stupid. I'm sorry.
He's just, oh, look at this blonde kid. He has orange skin, but like, I mean, or like golden skin, but like, I mean, hey, but like everybody else is like grizzled and hard and raw, and he's just some kid. And I kind of liked that sort of him sticking out like a sore thumb on X-Force. Because everybody does. You got like Warpath, who's a straight up murderer, who, you know, is a super hard person. You got Wolverine, who's an angry, stabby old man. You got, you know, you have Vanisher, who has head tattoos and had a brothel. Yeah, he has a brothel. did you guys ever see how Vanisher dies?
No.
Hopefully, it's good.
It happens in Second Coming, and during Second Coming, all Bastion had gathered all the different mutant hunting organizations together, and Bastion and Vanisher had teleported away quickly when he realized that was what they were doing, and he had teleported to his brothel, and he's like, Domino had punched him right before he teleported, and he's like, ladies, can you guys get me something, like some like a gauze for my nose? And he looks around, and all like the girls that he had there were dead, And he turns around, and I forgot which mutant hunting force was there, and they had killed all of them. He's like, and they're like, hey, you're gonna die now. And he, and they kill him, and he teleports as he's shot. He just like passes out and like just dies in this random field alone by himself.
Good. That's what he deserves.
Vanisher is kind of a terrible person.
You see, I think Vanisher deserves more of the hate than Elixir. I hated Vanisher. I'm just like, oh my god.
I think this is the first time I've seen Vanisher. So I think.
No, you've seen him in the X-Men cartoons.
Oh, okay. Well, Vanisher's yeah, but I'm talking about in comics. Yeah. One thing we haven't touched on that I really enjoyed, it was later in the event, was Xavier's kid, the pink guy.
Proteus,
yeah. The final fight with Proteus, with Magneto in the sky, and he's controlling.
That was intense.
That was so wild. I loved it. I did not expect it to go that haywire. And, like, the whole twist where he's, like, he lured Destiny there with fake, like, twisted up visions so they could all get there and he could take control of them and everything. I was like, man, this was really well constructed, and I really liked it. And I liked how Magneto did, like, the final blow to him. It was kind of like...
They definitely made Magneto's powers a lot cooler in that issue.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, man, you're breaking it down to such a minute thing of, like, oh, you are some form of energy, and I can control the energy and all this stuff. I was like, okay.
Well, you got to think about it. I mean, he's definitely... They're finally... I mean, not finally, but they... In moments in X-Men comics... They actually acknowledge how old Magneto is by showing how much experience he has over his power. Like, he can do so much controlling the magnetism of, you know, the energy of things. And to a molecular. Ooh, I can't speak.
Molecular?
Right. Yeah, that. I can't. My tongue is too big. He can control things to that level. And the fact that they actually kind of, I mean... They might not get the exact science right, but the fact that they're trying to get the exact science right and having Magneto explain what he can do, I love when they do that with certain characters, especially the X-Men, because X-Men have such a big level of power. When one of the mutants can actually understand the depth of their power to that minute kind of level, I feel like it's like amazing writing right there, at least in my opinion.
Don't remember how they explained his powers, but it was enough for me to be like, that's fine. I'm not gonna like argue with this. It wasn't the you have to autoclave your tools at 200 degrees Celsius kind of annoyance.
It didn't have to get into chemistry.
No, it didn't get like it did with Iceman.
What I did not like was creepy, horny Magneto trying to get on Rogue.
Oh yeah, I didn't like that.
I was like, this is super freaking uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I hated it during Age of Apocalypse, and I don't like it now.
I think there was like an entire series after Age of X-Men where Rogue and Magneto sort of like dated for a while, and like a lot of people sort of just brush it off. I don't really have an opinion on it because there's a lot of like relationships in the X-Men where I'm like, I don't know enough about this to like 100% say it's bad or it's good. With Magneto right. and Rogue, it's one of those things where it's like Rogue technically has lived the lives of so many other people. Would that make her maturity closer to Magneto or not? I don't know. Because like she definitely has lived multiple lives.
Right, right. So my whole thing was like, dude was at the Holocaust. She was not alive. That's the way I always gauge it. I was like, if you delete the whole Holocaust thing, maybe, but dude's been around for a while.
You can't really, and that's the thing, you really can't.
You can't. That's such a huge part of his character.
Yeah, and you can, like, they're going to use the excuse, oh, remember when he was de-aged? No, that doesn't count.
Yeah. Remember when he was Joseph? Remember when he was this?
See, it's sort of the same thing, like, I don't consider it as, okay, this is going to make me sound really bad, so I'm just going to, like, say it, whatever conclusion I get for this, I'll get for it. I think Magneto and Rogue is less creepy than Xavier and Jean, for the sole reason that Magneto and Rogue didn't meet each other until Rogue was at least like 23. So at the very least, you could be her. Like,
I will give
daddy.
You that.
That's true.
Like, that's it like the only creepy. Reason why I'm like, yeah, I think Rogue and Magneto is okay, because I've seen also, so many other people try to defend like Jean and Xavier, and no, I was like, if you say that to me, I'm gonna lose it. You know, that's the only reason why I'm like, yeah, maybe Rogue and Magneto could work.
Well,
everything is less creepier than Xavier and Jean. Everything is less creepy.
Right. And Professor X also trying to bone freaking Storm too. Like, he's got a thing about wanting to bone some of his students.
I know, it's really creepy. I mean, he's not the best person. So we've definitely realized that in all the comics. No one says Xavier is the best role model ever. He has some good ideas. He's a genius. But is he a good person? I don't think anyone ever says that he's a good person. So no, Jean and him should never be together. I don't think Magneto and Rogue should ever be together either, but it is less creepy.
You see, with Professor X, I think he definitely falls under the umbrella of you started off as a hero, but you lived long enough to make yourself become the villain. And I feel like he's lived long enough to be the villain. And right now, he's in this weird limbo place. So, I don't know how I feel about him. Well, I do. I hate him still.
Oh, mm-hmm. Charles, yeah.
Yeah. But anyways, back to Necrozma.
I think, like, okay, so the main, I don't hate and I don't like the, I think it's just an event for me. I apologize for having, like, such lukewarm takes this episode. It's just, I think, some of it was really cool, but because most of it was, like, told in such a bizarre... Like, the Necrosha plot for me, like, yes, it's over New X-Men and it's over Legacy, but it's mostly contained in X-Force, you know?
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't really consider, like, the parts that happened in New X-Men particularly, like, Necrosha-related. I think they're just, like, Necrosha-adjacent rather than, like... part of the actual event, because you could have just read X-Force and you'd be like, yeah, these three issues are Necrosha.
No, you couldn't just read X-Force because you need a break from that terrible art.
I hated that art.
That art was
I've
trash.
Seen better, but it wasn't that bad. I didn't mind it.
I don't like it. I like certain characters were drawn really well, but then some stuff I was just like, I don't want it no more. Especially because all the other books were drawn really nice.
They were. Some were drawn better.
So I just wanted to point this out because I was reading this and I was like, okay, this is interesting. But do you guys remember in Marauders where Bobby finds out that Pyro's alive again? And yeah. He's like, Pyro? The last time he's seen Pyro is actually in Necrosha. Necrosha knocked, and in Necrosha, Pyro almost killed Bobby.
Yeah.
That was their last interaction before Marauders. So yep. I'm curious to what happened like when they were on the ship together. And he had to explain to Pyro that the reason he's not going to trust him anytime soon is because he tried to kill him.
Right.
Here's the thing. I don't think any of them remembered being resurrected during Necrosha.
Oh, yeah, but I'm pretty sure Bobby still has, like, some
issues with it. Well, yeah, Bobby would remember.
Yeah.
Pepperidge Farm remembers.
But I think Bobby would remember. I feel like Bobby would probably just let it go. I'd probably just make some joke about it and then just, like, keep an eye on back.
I feel like Storm and Iceman are there because I feel like they are the ones that do not trust the other ones.
Well, yeah.
They don't trust Pyro and they don't trust Emma Frost. So I think like that's their reason for being on that team. So I would be interested to see the one-on-one between Pyro and Iceman, but I don't think Pyro's ever going to mess with Iceman again after he saw him straight up like kill some dudes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't see that. Bishop was only there. Pyro wasn't there. But I'm sure he heard about it. But, I mean, they were there to protect. They were there. I mean, Emma sent them there to protect Kitty anyway. I mean, they didn't do that great of a job of it. But
Mission failed.
But, you know, she'll probably come back. So.
But that is interesting that this is the last time Bobby did see Pyro. And then Avalanche. Was Avalanche there? It was Pyro and Avalanche, right?
There were so many past
no.
coming back.
Avalanche was Avalanche didn't die till he didn't die till Uncanny X-Men. Uncanny Avengers.
Okay.
I did like how like all these people coming back was kind of like a brain trip for these people, especially the way it hit Emma Frost, seeing the Hellions come back. That was insane. Like, she just could not handle it. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that she had to go in her diamond form because her brain was, like, losing it, I was like, dang, that was hard.
Yeah, I mean, and it was kind of nice that for Emma, too, but for all the other characters, but especially for Emma, who's always, like, such a hard personality, to actually see her that vulnerable and actually just lose control and just couldn't get herself together. Like, she was just not together. She had to be in the background, and Scott, I forgot who he sent to take her away, but he had to send somebody to take her away just so she wouldn't get, you know, killed.
I think Pixie.
A teleporter. But I really like that just raw emotion that a lot of some of these characters don't get. Like, they get a touch of emotion for, like, one or two panels, but this was, like, a few pages long where she just was inconsolable. She just wasn't there because of the trauma of seeing her past kids. I mean, if you think about it, she loved these kids. I mean, she taught them so many things, and, you know, she's the reason that they died. So, have them come back, and then they all blame you and try to attack you, that's, like, extreme trauma PTSD just hitting your whole body.
And it's interesting, too, because they were the one team that was going against the New Mutants. And that is, like, their nemesis, I guess. So it was cool seeing how twisted and how much they were, like, really messing with those guys. Mm-hmm. Except for Magic. She was like, I got this. I'm not scared of none of you guys.
I mean, Magic's never really... especially at that point in the story, she didn't really care. I mean,
dude, like, when the dude that was supposed to be Beelzebub showed up, and Magic's like, no. I know demons. You're no demon.
Oh, that was great. Well, speaking of New Mutants, I like in the beginning when we first get introduced to the New Mutants in this event, and they have the thought bubbles with Xavier and them all talking. I really like when that happens. They can translate what they actually mean by what they say. And I like the point where Magic's like Xavier's talking to her. She's like, "You don't matter to me. You don't matter for anything. I can't use you in any way, so I don't really care about you." And I was like, yeah, that seems right. What can he actually do for her? Nothing.
This event was really cool. I think one of my favorite parts is, I don't know if you guys saw some of the covers for X-Force during this, but I think they were variants, but they were themed after classic horror movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's so rad.
I'll share them in the chat sometime, but yeah, it was really cool. There was, I like when there's really neat cover concepts.
Right.
But it was cool. I really liked how this event came together, and I did really like how all the books were allowed to exist in their own stories, because there was references to stories that were happening, you know, in other people's stuff. I think I know what that song was. Good song, by the way.
That's what happens when people look at Instagram when they're on this podcast.
Anyway.
Juan.
No, but I totally agree how, like, these are all, like, pretty good self-contained stories. Like, I understand where Amos is also coming from, where it's kind of like the events seem kind of inconsequential, because I didn't feel like there was, like, it's weird to say, like, there was no big giant threat, but there was, but at the same time, I didn't feel like it was going to be earth-shattering, you know, like, this will change everything kind of event. I was like, oh, Celine's trying to raise the dead and become a god.
Well, it would have changed everything if she won, like, if she actually became that god level.
Yeah, but then I was like, find Scarlet Witch and say no more gods.
Oh, she can't always do that.
Like, my whole thing is, like, I feel like there's an easy out if Celine were to become a god.
No, I mean...
But I did like, I will say this, when she did get that power and it rippled effect through everyone that was a mystic. Yeah, that's not sad. Like how you saw Doom and Doctor Strange and Brother Voodoo, and they all felt it. I was like, that's pretty cool.
And that's why I think, even if, let's say, you said Scarlet Witch, she's magic, I think she would disrupt them, because she has that death negative energy. I mean, yeah, Scarlet Witch has negative energy too. So maybe it would cancel out? I don't know.
I'm like, Brother Voodoo and Doctor Strange together would probably be able to take her down.
Well, yeah.
So that's why I didn't feel like it was that big of a threat. I just love that this was more of an emotionally driven story. Like, all the emotions that were put into this by bringing back the dead, by putting these people against each other. Because you have Emma Frost going through it. You have Warpath going through it. You have the New Mutants going through it. You have Doug's story going through it, because his whole, like, what is my language thing, that was hitting me hard, like, yeah. Trying to figure out, like, what he meant by that, and at the end, him resolving what his language was, I was just like, oh my god, that was a really beautiful moment. And because him and Warlock have such a deep connection like that, that made me really enjoy that story. So this was more of definitely one of those stories where everyone's like, oh, the X-Men are about the drama. This story was about the drama.
Yeah, I mean,
more than it was about a big event.
Do you think that, like, given their connection, Doug and Warlock, do you think that's why Doug is having it be so put together during the whole Krakoa thing, because he has Warlock there with him? Like, because, you know, he's had some trauma, like losing his psyche a little bit and everything, and he knows a lot that's going on. Mm-hmm. Krakoa, I mean, he was part of how it got built with Xavier. So you think, since he has that, you know, kind of like relationship type love, mm-hmm, with Warlock, maybe that's how he's keeping it together so much in this, like, current, you know, Dawn of X storyline.
Douglock, I feel like Douglock is playing a big part of this. There's a reason why they hinted it in the Nightcrawler, the quote-unquote Nightcrawler giant size. Because the last time we did see Warlock in Dead Souls, he was observing all of the New Mutants. Mm-hmm. And we don't know why.
Mm-mm, still don't.
Still don't. But I feel like there's something going on with Warlock, because when Professor X took Doug to Krakoa to check it out, to start talking to Krakoa, one thing he did was touch the plant, and we saw Warlock phasing with the plant. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's something there too.
Yeah, they did that for a reason. That's going to come back.
Those little nuggets Hickman likes to throw in there in passing.
That is a good point. That is something interesting to bring up. One thing I like about this event really has a lot of the same stuff Dawn of X had, you know, reviving, stuff involving the techno-organic virus, really heartfelt reunions between characters. And so Selena gets a point over Xavier, because Selena brought back Destiny, so Selena's a better person than Xavier. Boom, said it. But that scene at the end where it was just, where they were like, hey, can we just, like, bring you with us? You know? And she's like, no, I just want to see the sunset.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that hurts. Because I wish Mystique had gotten to be there. Mystique would have been so excited to see Destiny. Just like,
I was thinking the same thing.
No, and I love that moment. I feel like Rogue and Destiny needed that moment alone, because
that's fair.
She wasn't there for the actual death, so this was her, you know, closure. And I loved it because Destiny's like, you and Raven mean the world to me. Like, you guys are basically the only thing that ties me to want to stay here. And that's little tender moment that Rogue's like, you know, I love you too. Like, they were her moms, essentially. And then she goes, I gotta leave you here, but stay here and watch the sunset. I hear it's gonna be beautiful. And I was just like, oh man, knowing what we know now of Destiny, it's one of those things, like, it's so crazy, like, reading all these stories, again, knowing what we know where the stories are currently, it hits a little harder, I guess, or you get that aha moment now reading these stories, like, oh, okay, I hope they pick up that plot point again. So this, for me, was like, man, poor Destiny. I hope she comes back somehow.
She will, or Krakoa will burn. It's just how it is.
Right. And going with that, like Amos has said before, like, I really want to see if they do bring Blindfold back, or if Blindfold is even going to be mentioned again.
Actually, what I would want to see, I just thought of it, speaking of past characters coming back, I know X Factor is going to, like, investigate, you know, past deaths or anything, or, you know, who
should... Anomalies and
deaths. Yeah, anomalies and deaths. No one has questioned Proteus, right? Him guy? Him being in the five that bring people back. Because he's been very, like, destructive. I know everyone's getting a second chance, so I just said that. But, like, they haven't touched on it at all. Because he's very unstable.
Well, Leah Williams says that this will also focus on the five.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm bringing it back to. I'm just like, yeah, I wonder if anyone's going to be like, hey, should we be okay? Is anyone keeping an eye on him on Proteus in the top five? Like, is anyone, like, keeping track of him or trying to keep him on a leash? Because he's, like, very manipulative and destructive. What's keeping him calm, you know? Is it because he found a purpose, finally, or a family? Is that just what he needed to finally, you know, fix his brain? Because also
I think we're probably... That's going to probably be touched on in the Moira series.
So I don't think it... I don't know if you guys remember when the last time we saw Proteus was. Astonishing X-Men, yeah. And it was a really good story, and he held so much guilt towards Xavier, and he was telling Betsy about, like, how much, like, they killed him, and he misses his mother and all that kind of stuff, and he kind of finally he doesn't really find peace during that issue, but, like, Betsy kind of gets to calm him down, and he stops warping reality. So I think part of it is that, like, maybe he's finally, like, because he's revived, but he's revived in a way that, like, now he has a purpose and he doesn't have to, like, body snatch people. Mm-hmm. And then, like, he has a steady supply of Xavier bodies, which is really creepy. Like, I'm not really gonna go into how, like, I don't like cloning, but the thing is with that specific thing, and I think it's just because that he doesn't have to kill people anymore, so he doesn't feel like he has to be evil anymore, because I think that was, like, the main concern with him up until this point was that he had to be evil because that's how his powers manifested.
That is true. And see, that brings it back full circle, that the powers are really controlling the people. Like, this making them evil because they have this urge to do what their power is making them do.
It's in their nature.
Yeah, to make them feel better, they have to give in to that urge. And since he doesn't have to body snatch anymore, or he does body swap, but he doesn't have to do it with, like, a living being per se, so he doesn't have to, like, actually take control of the whole town and try to kill them he did in Astonishing X-Men.
Speaking of which, that was a wild series.
It was. The first half was kind of crazy.
Astonishing X-Men is one of my favorite series of 2018.
The first half or the second half?
First half. See, okay, so I like the entire series, but I don't think it's one book. It's kind of like saying, yeah, I like Uncanny 1963, you know? Like, that's 600 issues of, like what part of Uncanny 1963 do you like, you know?
Yeah.
I definitely like both parts of the books. I think Rosenberg did a hilarious job. And I think Greg Land actually did a really good job on the second part of the art. And, like, I'm not the one to ever, like, praise Greg Land, but I think, like, that actually did look decent, and I didn't know it was him until I looked it up.
I'll give you that. I will absolutely give you that.
I think that was a fun story for Alex, and to see, like, the X-Men kind of lose their marbles for a while, especially when you see someone like Hank, and he's like, yeah, I've had Banshee in like storage for the past 10 years. He's like dead, but not really. A lot of, I think that was really good for Rosenberg. I think he did really good writing on that. And I think Charles Sewell did like extremely good writing in Astonishing X-Men. I think like the first part, and I think he did like very well. He did very well with like, I didn't like the fact that he kind of retconned his own issue by like being like, nobody remembers it happens because Xavier like took everyone's memories away. I didn't like that part, but I thought it was a lot of fun exploring like Betsy's relationship with Phantom X, Betsy's relationship with Warren, how Charles sees himself in the grand scheme of things, how he does view himself as sort of a god. I think that's a very interesting plot point. I love Astonishing. I'm sorry. It's like one of the first comics I picked up, and I was like, yes, I love this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Really, that was one of my favorites, actually, in 2018, too, both parts. I liked Rosenberg's more, but I did love the whole Proteus saga of the whole thing with all the mines and everything. I really loved that, because we haven't seen Psylocke really that much. Well, we have, but we haven't seen her in the forefront that much, so I like that. Except when she killed Magneto, like, a few issues before that or something like that.
I really liked the Astonishing X-Men annual that Rosenberg did, where it was what's his name, Xavier, using
the original five?
Yeah, he got the original four other than Cyclops. He's like, hey guys, let's have dinner together.
That was so trippy.
Everybody's automatically like, no, I don't want to be here with you. But I liked it because Warren, I think, wears a crop top in that issue, and it was very enjoyable.
Okay, so I'm just going to say something. That's the last time the O4 saw Xavier before House of X.
Yup.
Yeah.
And they were all like, fuck him. They were all like, yep, we're not going to do this anymore. And then to see them like being so like docile and accepting in House of X.
They all got mind wiped except for Warren.
Well, I think Warren's implied to have gotten like mind wiped, but also like you can't technically mind wipe Warren because he has Psyblocks that are as strong as Apocalypse's. I know a lot of Warren lore. I apologize. This is what I have my PhD in.
Hey, no, someone's got to know somebody's stuff.
Yeah, but Xavier didn't know that he didn't mind wipe Warren.
No,
he thought he did.
That's why they had that little side panel where you see Warren kind of like, oh, shit.
Yeah. So Warren kept that to himself. And that's actually a good point, Amos. I wonder if that will actually be brought up. That might actually be brought up in the Phantom X Giant Size. Because as we've seen, the Giant Size aren't always about that character. So what if the Phantom X Giant Size is bringing up, you know, past Astonishing X-Men stuff?
One thing, to the point of why the X-Men are so docile towards Xavier now is because as much as I don't like Rosenberg Uncanny X-Men, and I've made that point very clear, it really did set up Hoxbox, because I don't think X-Men and mutants as a whole would have been so open to Xavier's new plan if they hadn't been brought down to their absolute lowest point.
Right.
Definitely. And
so, like, everybody's like, oh, why are they being so friendly? Why are they acting so out of character? Why are they doing this? Why are they being more extreme? Because they were almost wiped out to existence in the last year, and yeah, it happens all the time for them, but it was one of the most devastating mutant destruction. We had mutants committing suicide because they were mutants being gunned down, mutants, you know, their powers being taken from them.
Right.
So them going along with whatever Xavier has planned, it makes sense, and it's kind of good. For as much as I didn't like Rosenberg X-Men, it really did set up the incoming stories very well, even though apparently he had to change it midway, because apparently there was all the mutants that were dead weren't like originally I heard that the story was supposed to be that all the mutants that they had found that had died or killed themselves weren't really dead. It was just Xavier and it was Xavier and Cyclops had a secret plan that they were just mind wiping everybody of the existence of these certain things, and then at like the last possible moment they were gonna spring a surprise on whoever they were battling, which that's very convoluted, but apparently it had to change midway through with Hickman's plans.
Yeah, Hickman was like, no, hold on.
He's like, no, hold on, kill everybody. Like, kill
everybody. I kind of dig the whole Emma manipulation thing a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, that's very on brand for her. I wasn't shocked by that at all.
Especially after becoming the Black King, taking up the mantle again.
Yeah. And I really agree with you, Fox, that, I mean, I like the Rosenberg run. It definitely had its faults, but I agree that it did set up House of X really well. And that does show that, I mean, all the mutants are just tired of fighting each other. They're tired of, you know, being Xavier versus, you know, Cyclops, or Cyclops versus Wolverine.
All these schisms.
Yeah, all these agendas going against each other. Oh, you don't have the right idea. You don't have the right idea. They're like, we finally have a way to all come together. Let's just make it work. You know, let's just try to make this work. We're all together. This is a clean slate. Let's try to make it work as much as possible. And I feel like that is something that's popped in my head. I feel like that's why in Hellions 2, just to bring this up, I feel like that's why they're listening to people like Sinister and giving his ideas too, because they're like, well, we might not have the solution. You know, he might have the solution at this point. Let's hear him out. Let's not do the way we usually do things. Let's try to do something new, because the way we did things before, it didn't work out. We kept getting destroyed. We kept getting killed. Our houses kept blowing up.
Okay, so Uncanny 2019, I kind of stopped reading halfway through after Ruth's suicide. And that was like because that like issue, it kind of showed me that a lot of the male writers were just, there was a lot going on during that time in X-Men, because Age of X-Men was running like alongside. And the problem with Uncanny was that it was so gritty and so dark, and I think it was supposed to play off like how bright and how colorful Age of X-Men is.
Right.
But both of them were so poorly executed that both of them were not enjoyable for me. But my main beef with Uncanny 2019, and this is just like a me thing, is that every time they bring up the mutant vaccine, I'm like, that is physically impossible for you to do. No matter what, because as we've established, it's a genetic thing, and you can't vaccinate against genetics. Like, that was, like, my main takeaway of Uncanny 2019. That's the only thing I remember I actively was complaining about during the time.
Well, so they did that, too, in New X-Men back in the day, Grant Morse's run, where they found a cure.
Yeah, was that New X-Men? I'm pretty sure it was Astonishing.
What? Yeah, that was
The Grant Morrison one, when they found a cure for a mutant gene?
I'm pretty sure it was Joss Whedon's.
Joss Whedon? Okay. I got it mixed up.
Who knows? They've done that so many times.
I know, I got it mixed up. But yeah, they definitely touched on that a lot. I'm glad that hopefully that was the last time they're going to do it for a while, because that's kind of run into the ground.
Just bring Kavita Rao back and just let her hang out with the X-Men again. She's a human. She put in her work as a human, and she gets to hang out. She gets to hang out to come to the habitats.
See, that's why I want Leah Williams' run so bad, because all these things that I'm wondering about, she's touching upon, like on the Five, about the people the humans that live on Krakoa, the people that are in relationships with mutants that are living in Krakoa, how do these human partners assimilate to that culture? Like, those are all the things that I want to see and know about, and we gotta freaking wait longer.
Oh, speaking of which, I just found out something before I started the podcast. I don't know if this is real or not, so this could be just, it could just be a placeholder. It could be just a placeholder date, but I was looking at Marvel.com, and apparently X-Factor and Children of the Atom are listed for July July 15th.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
But what makes me think this is a placeholder is so is the other one book I'm really excited for, Champions, is also listed for July 15th. And okay. If you notice, July 15th is the next date right after they have the cutoff of all the books that they've previously given a list, given release dates for. So I'm worried this might be a placeholder date.
Right.
It also might not be. So I'm just kind of hoping that we do, because getting both those books on 1 week would be so fantastic.
It'd be some good reading. Oh,
definitely.
That'd be a good week.
I don't know. The comics coming back things is really funny, because like my friends who are into DC were talking about how they're getting comics in 2 days, and I was like, God, I wish that was me. now that I'm not into DC, I'm just like not actively reading any of the newer books. I kind of stopped reading DC back in 2016 after Tim Seeley took over Nightwing, and that made me stop reading comics forever. Not forever, until like my friend forced me to watch the X-Men movies. But I kind of wish Marvel took that approach of like having a digital release and a physical release. I think that would have been, or like only digitally releasing like the books they knew that were going to have like floppy sales too. Like, not all the X-Men books, but I know a lot of the other books that are currently running, like Strange Academy, all that kind of stuff, have had like a lot of physical sales. And people who are going to buy the digital are usually going to buy the floppy too. Because if you read solely digital, you've never bought a floppy before. But like, I've done the thing where I bought the digital copy and I bought the original copy. I own so many issues of Iceman. It's terrible. I have, like, because I was so excited, sometimes I couldn't just wait to, like, get to the store because I had class. I wanted to read Iceman right now.
Yeah.
You know? So that was, like, so that's what I'm thinking is, like, they could have done that kind of thing. Maybe not release all the books if we're going to be released that day, but the ones that they knew would have physical sales also.
Right.
I'm sorry. That was, like, a really long rambling thought.
Oh, no.
You got a point, The X-Men, personally, I think the X-Men books should have been released digitally, even if other they weren't getting done physically, because if you notice, the X-Men books are selling incredibly well. The Dawn of X books are getting sold incredibly well, digitally speaking, because even weeks after the books had stopped coming out, the Dawn of X books were still on the top 10 books for Comixology, even through all the other books having sales on them. So at the very least, because that's the thing, Jonathan Hickman plans everything so far in advance. I personally don't think they really needed to sort of delay that plan and put hooks in that plan, because they could have just, when physical books came out, they could have just still released them, like staggered the release. But I at least for the Dawn of X books, I don't see why they couldn't have just kept going with digital releases for them. Because not only didn't have momentum from just the people reading them digitally, you had all, because with it all being one big interconnected web, you would have had the physical buyers still buying it too.
Right.
It just, and it would have been good to keep hold over comic fans, and you know, with them only the Dawn of X books being the ones coming out, that would have gotten a lot of maybe the people who hadn't been reading Dawn of X comics into reading the Dawn of X comics, because they had nothing else to spend their money on.
I mean, that's definitely a fair point, but I feel like Marvel and other comic book companies too, I feel like they did this just so they can have still like a good faithful standing with the comic book stores. Just like they're not being like, you know, they're saying that, you know, we still need y'all. You know, they're being it was like a respectful thing. You know, like, hey, we don't want to release anything because we don't want to, you know, have y'all lose out on any money just in case someone doesn't decide to buy this physical just because they have it on digital now. Or they didn't want them to be overrun with issues in case they decided to release them all, even though they're already on digital like they had a whole set out because they didn't know how long this quarantine was going to last. I just think it was definitely out of respect for comic book stores and just to make sure that they aren't hurt in any way.
Okay, so, like, I'm currently looking at the list of DC Comics, and I know that they usually release, like, a gazillion comics. And they only have released, like, I think 8, and they're all, like, the comics that you know, if someone's going to buy this, they're also going to buy the physical. Because it's, like, Batman and the Outsiders, The Flash, Hawkman, Joker and Harley, Criminal Sanity, and, like, Green Lantern Season 2. So these are all books that you know are going to do well, like, whether you release them digitally or not. And, like, they had the metrics for this if they just analyzed their data. And right. Here's the thing. I'm not ever going to defend, like, Disney. I'm never going to do that. But Disney could have absorbed the hit, and they could have backed comic book stores in different ways. You know, because, like, Boom and a lot of the other indies who are going to, like, they're going to get hit a lot more than DC and Marvel because they missed a month or two of publishing, you know?
Right.
The indies are offering comic books. They're like, here, we're going to give you, like, these variants that you can make money off of, and we're going to give you this, and we're going to help you cancel these orders, and we're going to help you out. And, like, DC and Marvel don't really seem to care. Well, at least Marvel, because DC is doing this thing where they're like, we're going to have more publishers. We're not going to just, like, depend on Diamond. And I think it's dumb for Marvel to have not at least, like, considered looking at other publishers, because DC was looking at it for, like, a really long time. And I think now even Midtown Comics is going to become a publisher, which is unheard of, because they're not for DC, but I know they're thinking of becoming a publisher. And that's, like, unheard of for a comic book store, you know?
Hey, that's branching out and doing something that might actually help you survive once, if comic book stores go out of business, that's their way of staying afloat.
Yeah, I agree that they should look for different publishers, but I support their decision in not releasing anything digital because I think it gave comic book stores still a chance when actual books still come out.
You see, like, to me, I'm in the middle of both of y'all, both of sides of this coin, because I feel like what Marvel could have done is release the books that were mid-tier. Release those books, because guess what? If those are the only books getting released right now, people are more than likely going to pay for them. The ones that you saw that were struggling a little bit or weren't doing as many sales, put those on digital, you know? Instead of, like, getting rid of all these other teams that were writing off these, like, miniseries, the miniseries should have been on freaking digital. I don't think they should have waited for those. And, like, because they're going to have a hard time picking up the momentum again or having that same steam that some of those books were getting, like Doctor Strange Academy. I feel like that one probably lost a lot of momentum, having this huge gap of it now, and who knows when I can't remember when the next release of it is. The thing is, it's gonna be hard for them to pick up the numbers again. That's why I felt like they should have been releasing a little something, you know. Like, if you don't release your big titles, that's fine, release the small ones.
I think once comics start publishing again, I think this would give, like, Empire a really good boost, and whether Empire is going to be good or not is I honestly don't know, because you have E-Wing writing it, and you have Dan Slott writing it, and those are, like, two completely different sides of the coin. They're two very different writers, so I'm not sure how Empire is going to be, but because it's going to be, like, the first event once we come out of quarantine, that event is going to be a success, whether or not the writing is good or not, whether or not it makes any sense, just because we're so excited for something new.
Right.
So I don't think Marvel is going to suffer, like, any losses this quarter.
What? My one big problem is that, like, the release schedule, how they're releasing things now, really bothers me, because there's, like, 2 weeks between when new comics are coming out that there's only trades. I'm not saying go full steam ahead, but you have to mix in your trade releases and your new comic releases, because a lot of these books are probably all stuff that are being released in trade are all stuff people probably caught up on.
Exactly.
While during quarantine, that's, you have to give a steady stream, because there's, I think when the release starts again, there's like a 2-week gap between when there's new comics and no, and you know, when there's just trades coming out. I think that's poor decision making. I think they could have come up with a better release schedule. You can't don't just do floppies or just don't do trades. You gotta mix it up.
See, this is another hot take of mine, and I'm saying this as someone who's never studied business minus one class of like risk management in college. So this might be completely bad or anything, but I think what Marvel should have done during this time is, because they have Marvel Unlimited, they should have uploaded all the comics that were released up until March onto Unlimited, because that would excite people to buy the ones, buy the new ones that are going to come out, because a lot of them left on like cliffhangers.
Build the hype.
Like that way, first of all, more people are going to buy Unlimited because now they can catch up on like all the comics. Secondly, because of that, you're going to build up hype for the new comics that are going to come out. Like, you don't have to add like the newer ones, but at least at this point, you're going to garner new fans, you know? Right. Like, it's not going to cost Marvel that much, because a lot of these people were going to wait the next 6 months anyway to read it on Marvel Unlimited.
Exactly. I think that would have been a smart idea.
But then again, I've only taken one business class, so that could be a completely terrible idea.
The thing is, it would have been a smart idea, but at the same time, they wouldn't have made money from Unlimited, because they did give free month of Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It would be hard to get people to pay for it after they just caught up on everything that was current.
I mean, I guess, but it's like, see, like, I haven't really signed up for Marvel Unlimited, to be honest. Right. Because I don't really, like, read comics online. It's really hard for me, and I don't like the app. I think Marvel Unlimited has, like, the least friendly user interface.
Yeah, it's really confusing. I hate having to go back to everything that I'm reading.
So there's a lot of things wrong with the app, and I would have never paid for it anyway. But the thing, like, I'd rather just buy the book. I'd rather have, like, a physical trade. Like, a lot of my trades are, like, really busted up because of how many times I reread them, you know?
Right.
So, it's just, like, Marvel could have done a lot of things that were smarter in, like, the release of their books and the release of their, or at least, maybe not smart financially, but, like, smart financially in the long run. Because a lot of fans are going to be, like, huh, what are you going to do, like, next time something like this happens? Are we going to have to, like, because DC had a lot more, like, so, okay, so I'm sorry, I'm not here to, like, defend DC, but DC had just lost its editor-in-chief,
right,
and then it went into quarantine, and it made a lot more smarter decisions towards how to react to this crisis than Marvel did, because Marvel kept us in the dark for so long.
Oh, yeah. This is a thing, though. I feel like Jim Lee had more to do with that, because not only him running his own, you know, company before, but him also being a creative, he knew everything that needed to happen. He already kind of had something in plan of like, okay, this is how we can move forward from this point on. Whereas Marvel is now owned by Disney, and Disney doesn't see Marvel publishing as anything worthwhile because they don't make that much money off of it. They get more money off of Marvel toy lines than they do off the comics. They didn't consider that a huge priority. So that's why we stayed in the dark, because they didn't have anything to share with us, because they didn't care enough to do anything for them.
I mean, yeah.
Jim, another thing I think is, I feel like a lot of the stuff Marvel has done to quote unquote help comic shops during this has been very superficial. Like, sure, putting, you know, an ad during the digital comics about where to find physical comics is cool, but also, like, Jim Lee has been doing all kinds of, he's like, it felt like almost a new art a day that's going to support comic shops. If you notice, right. He's been doing and knocking these paintings out of the park, and they've been gorgeous, and they've been selling for, you know, upwards of thousands of dollars. And like, that's, I remember, where
him being a former creative and a former owner comes into play. He knows what needs to be done. He needs to show that they're out there supporting. He's the soldiers on, like, the boots on the field kind of guy. You know, get them out there, show them you're supporting them, show a face, show that you're have everyone's back. But Marvel doesn't have someone like that.
Sad.
Like, C.B. Cebulski is not the best person to be in charge of shit.
Yeah. C.B. Cebulski is, I like him, but he's also very corporate minded.
Yeah.
He's not very creative minded. Right. Like, he's good at getting creators back. Like, I mean, he got Hickman back.
Right.
When Hickman said he wouldn't work for Marvel ever again. After,
he's a business dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, I feel like if Quesada would have had more, he probably would have done almost as much as Jim Lee was doing.
I don't think so.
No?
No. Quesada's very stubborn and hot-headed. And, like, I mean, Quesada's the reason we're never having Marvel-DC crossovers ever again. Because in one of the early, when one of Quesada's earliest, like, interviews, when he was, you know, started being higher up at Marvel, he said DC doesn't know what they're doing with their characters, and I'm pretty sure he used some expletives, and someone up higher up at DC said, we are, in as long as Quesada is working there, we are never working with Marvel ever again. And I'm like, yikes. So, Quesada burns bridges.
I think, like, also another problem with Marvel in general is because they have the editor-in-chief, and then they have, like, the offices. Like, you have the X office, you have the... I forgot what they're called. The Avengers have their own office, the Fantastic Four have their own office, which makes sense because it's, like, a huge company. But, like, you can... Like, it feels like... It doesn't feel like a universe. It doesn't feel like the Marvel 616 universe when you read different comics sometimes. I think because it's so segregated, it's sort of hard to know what's going on in the offices. I could be wrong because I have never worked at Marvel. I am not pursuing a career at Marvel unless you want, like, a fact checker for whatever Hank says.
Or you no, you should be a science advisor.
Yeah, just go. Like, I only do molecular biology. I don't do anything bigger than that. So I apologize. That's, like, my only qualification in life is to talk about things that are really small. But it just, I don't know. Marvel made a lot of really stupid decisions in informing people what they're going to do. Absolutely. However, not to take away from this conversation, but can we talk about, like, Jim Lee and how he kind of sort of defined the X-Men for a really long time?
I mean, feel he did.
Like, his style and, like, the way he drew. I'm remembering an article, Claremont and Jim Lee were having, like, a conversation with one of the interviewers, and Claremont was like, the reasons I wanted to work with Jim Lee so much was because, like, he drew all the characters so sexy.
Right.
And it's, like, going back and looking at the, like, X-Men run, which is one of my favorites, I think he defined the style of each X-Men really well. You know, like, absolutely. You can tell the X-Men had style. Like, like, Bobby looked a little bit schlubby. Warren always dressed really nicely. Betsy had, like, a variety of outfits that, like,
she actually looked like a model that she was supposedly be.
Yeah. And, like, because it was right after she took over Kamanin's body. So, like, you can see that, like, difference in her style of how she was dressing. She wore a lot of, like, really long slit dresses. Jean had, like, this fat, like, fashionable mom style. Right. I feel like I kind of...
Jeans and a blouse.
Yeah, so, like, this is more criticism. I'm sorry, my brain works in really weird ways, but you guys mentioned Jim Lee, and I had this on my mind today morning, so I thought I'd mention it. But I think the one thing that I would continue from that of, like, a criticism of, like, House of X and Powers of X, which we will be reading next week, and boy, do we have some opinions on it.
Yes.
The thing is that House of X and Powers of X sort of took that personality away from the X-Men by having them be in uniforms a lot of the time. Like, not to say I don't like the uniform, because a lot of the redesigns are really fun. I really like Apocalypse and Richter's new uniforms particularly. But the fact that they're never in, like, their civvies anymore sort of takes away from their personality. It feels like a lot of the characters lack that sort of, like, what makes them.
Right.
I mean, I didn't start in House of X or Power of X. I mean, I feel like a lot of X-Men group comic books have always had uniforms.
Well, no,
like them being in their uniforms all the time.
It's been a lot more recently. I feel like it all started once the Schism stuff happened, with Cyclops having his own thing and then Wolverine and the X-Men having their own thing. A lot of them stuck to their uniforms. And ever since then, you really haven't seen them in, like, civilian clothes.
Well, if you think about it, like, before then, they were allowed to go out more because a lot of people didn't know they were mutants. But now they've been on such a defense for, like, the past 10 years because people have been hunting them down more.
Well, even when they were hanging out, in, like, the mansion, they were in there.
Well, yeah, because look how many times the mansion is attacked suddenly. They're like, well, might as well just keep this on because be prepared, because even when we're, like, sitting down watching a movie, drinking hot chocolate, a sentinel, a sinister, anybody could just be crashing through the roof trying to kill us.
It leans into the fact that the X-Men have become more militarized lately.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing, and that really sucks, but I also, that's why, in my opinion, Marvel should have someone, like, say, and I don't mean to just use this person as an example, because I very obviously stan them, is they should have someone like Chris Anka on retainer in a contract designer form for Marvel to be able to design clothing for these people. Yeah. And really design and design costumes and design outfits, because one thing I will always use as an example, depending on how you feel about the story of Runaways by Rainbow Rowell, because I know a lot of people are hit or miss on that, but the art is fantastic and the style is fantastic. Everybody has their own unique outfits.
Absolutely.
And has their own, and their outfits really go along with who they are as characters. Right. And so, and even when Chris Anka had to redesign or give them designs for their superhero costumes in the recent arc of Runaways, he gave them costumes that fit well for who they were as characters. Right. And Chris Anka, for the longest time, has been redesigning characters and made them look fantastic. And even casual wear that he's put these characters in, they look fantastic. Marvel should have someone like that.
Well, the thing is,
go ahead.
They do have someone in the X office. No, I'm like, in the X office, they have Pepe LaRaza and Russell Dodderman, who both gave fashion to Emma Frost again. Amazing fashion, I add. Some of the best looks, but we don't get to see them that often because we have had them in their civvies. Like when Cyclops and Shinobi Shaw, Magneto, Professor X, and Apocalypse went to go meet with that group, they all dressed up in formal wear. Like they were wearing suits. They looked dapper. They were looking fly as hell. But that's when they have to go and be kind of like homogenized to like what the rest of the humans wear.
Yeah.
They have to put on their human clothes.
But see, I mean, think of the stories that we've seen so far in Dawn of X. When have we really seen them, other than in Krakoa on the island, like out in public without having like a mission to go on to help? Because this is like the beginning stages of Krakoa. So maybe like the second line. Maybe like after this year when things start maybe calming down in Krakoa in certain stories, maybe we'll get them more relaxed and more like in regular wear instead of like, you know, like the militant wear, like Fox said, like being always prepared to fight or defend. Maybe they'll get more relaxed.
Okay, so a friend and I were talking about this. My friend is a fan artist and I'm a writer, so we constantly create characters and we constantly like creative passion, and we have boards for this, and like, so I know like the creative process behind like creating a costume. And we ended up talking about mutant fashion in the sense outside of like Jumbo Carnation, because you do have Jumbo Carnation, who is a fashion designer. But the thing is that a lot of the fashion is so Western, and it's it's just Western fashion, readjusted for people who have like extra arms or something, versus like something that could come out of like a mutant fashion, like maybe they use the plants that they have in Krakoa to make their fashion,
right.
The fauna that works there, like it could be so creative as to give Krakoa more life outside of like we've imported like the silk from Spain, and silk isn't imported from Spain. I'm trying to remember where silk is imported from. I'm gonna say China. If I'm wrong, feel free to correct me. But we have the silk imported, blah blah blah. I feel like you have so much potential to create, to give these characters a little bit more life by having mutant fashions and fashions that like, absolutely, like blend in with Krakoa more. And like, it doesn't have to be like a big thing. Like, we don't need like an entire issue on like Jumbo Carnation creating fashion for every single X-Men. But I feel like,
even though I would love that.
We all would love that. I feel like having Xavier, Magneto, and Apocalypse not in suits, but in like formal Krakoan wear or something like that would have given X-Men 4 a bigger impact, that like, we're here and we're not gonna even follow your rules. It's sort of like how I would go to a lot of meetings wearing like a hijab and like wearing an abaya. Like, that's how I present myself formally, right, versus how I present myself regularly, where it's like I wear shirts and I wear skirts. I assume that's what I wear. I don't know. I just packed all my luggage, so I don't really know. But giving that sort of fashion that's like doesn't look right within American society would give them like that extra edge of like, yes, we are our own society. These are the rules that we follow. And like, I don't doubt that there are two nudists on Krakoa, and I will name them right now, when they are Warren and Aurora, that refuse to wear clothes. But like, I'm sure that if they just thought of that, like, it doesn't have to be something magnificent and new, but something that is just for the mutants, you know?
Right. You see, I hate to keep going back to this goddamn book, but X-Factor was showing that. Like, I know some of y'all don't like the outfits, but, like, they had their own fashion for that team. That team was serving their look. Whether you like it or not, that team has their own look. They're not in any of the uniforms that, yeah, from their previous history, previous incarnations, they have their own looks. And that's what I really liked about that book.
I feel like maybe that's the start of it. Because, you know, like I said before, this is they're trying to establish, you know, rules and, you know, socialism and, you know, connecting with the other countries and continents and all that and other societies. They're trying to, like, I would love for them to establish more of their cultural fashion with that as well, you know, doing it all at the same time. But I feel like they're prioritizing more. And I feel like I hope that we will actually get to that point where we have more like, oh, this is their Krakoan, you know, symbol with this, you know, this is their traditional that we just made up, you know, traditional wear, or you know, this is our nice fancy attire that we're going to wear for this event. Not your style, but this is mutant Krakoa style. Like, I hope that we get to that point.
See, like, this is, I don't know how far you guys have read ahead in, like, the solicits, but I think next month we were supposed to get, like, the Captain Britain versus Krakoa issue of Excalibur. I think that was supposed to be next month.
Yeah.
Supposed to be. But I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about this in the terms of, like, how could you develop Krakoa as a society using that plot point? And all I could think of is that Betsy decides to revoke her Krakoan citizenship to only be British. However, she marries someone Krakoan so that they have like that sort of unity. And then you can have like this idea of like a royal wedding. And I know like everyone's like, we don't need another wedding issue in X-Men. However, I think it'd be really great to have like establish like how weddings look like on Krakoa, especially like even if it's a political wedding, it's still a wedding.
Right.
Like, you know, like how do we show the world that we are Krakoa and like this is how we do weddings and this is how we accept people into our culture. Like, I feel like that would be an interesting take, but also I really want like another wedding issue in X-Men. And
it's gonna be Emma Frost and Iron Man the next wedding.
Ew.
I was really hoping for it. Not to sound like a filthy like Psy Angel stan, but I would really like to them for them to like reconcile. You know, and like them.
Yeah.
And like Warren is kind of like the quintessential like pretty boy. Right. You know, he's like the OG pretty boy of the X-Men.
When is the last time they have they talked recently at all?
Uncanny X-Men 2018 when Betsy stabs him in the head.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. That's the last very time romantic. They
Right before Age of X-Men.
Control is,
I
think all of this falls in line with first they have to establish a church.
Yes.
I feel like once they establish their religion and their religious beliefs,
they'll get more cultural.
Everything else comes from that. I feel like everything's going to stem from that because they just set up their own laws. So I feel like after the laws, their religion, from their religion, their perspective of everyday society there, because they really haven't established the status quo of day to day there. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's just a bunch of people partying and humping all over the place and sometimes dying. So that's it.
See, like, this is a concept. We've probably gone over the time limit at this point, but a concept that I'm always obsessed with is human immortality. And once we are immortal, how do we decide our moral compass and why do we decide ethics?
Right.
Because a lot of us are like, yeah, we're good. So in the end of this, we are going to heaven. You know, that's like, it's not me making a generalization, but that's how a lot of people feel about like they're not good people because they want to be good people, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to ignore the fact that like death, because it's such a great equalizer, is the reason why some of us have morals.
Right.
And I say some of us like very generally, like, and I feel like that might not apply to the X-Men now, and like how are they going to be able to reconcile with like why we should do good? How do we choose our morals?
I'm sorry,
I like philosophy.
No, I absolutely really like what you're going with, because that's what I've exactly been wondering, because I'm like, A, what do they really worship? B, what is their morality? Like, where's their, how far are they like willing to do things to? And what is their motivation to be good people? Like you said, what's their end all be all? They already technically are in their version of heaven. So what do you have to live for, essentially?
Like also, why would you have to work if everything's already done?
Exactly.
Because this argument happens in the real life when we're like, oh, if we give any, this is going to get really political, I apologize. But I'm a personally believer in like the universal, everyone getting like a universal fund and then you work if you want to get more money. I'm a personal believer in that because I think everyone deserves like a basis to live. And then if you want to earn more, you can earn more, you know. But on Krakoa, there's this thing where money isn't really a thing anymore. So if you want to achieve more, what's pushing you? Like, yeah. For me, I'm a huge fan of education, and I would have, even if I get paid poorly, I would continue to pursue my education no matter what. And I think, my drive for it is just wanting to know more, you know? That's, like, my personal drive for it. But all the people just study up to a PhD so that they can get, like, a six-figure salary.
Right.
You know? Like, there's... Like, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just want to make that clear. I'm just saying that, like, there's so much to explore in Krakoa because it talks about fears that we do have in real life, about, like, if we do give everyone, like, a perfect standard of living, are we going to progress as a society, you know? Because there's this inherent belief that capitalism is a drive for necessity, a drive for, like, innovation, you know?
Right.
And Krakoa is essentially not capitalist in any way or form. You know, they don't rely on exports, they don't rely on imports, they have their own economy secluded from the rest of the world, So they are basically the perfect country to test this in and, like, to explore these, like, philosophies of will we actually work after this? Like, it's not like an actual scientific experiment, but it's, like, fun to play with those philosophies with these characters.
Right.
Especially the X-Men who've been through so much. You know, like, are they just going to relax after all this is done?
Yeah, that's okay. I feel like we can talk more on this next week when we go in Hotspot, because I feel like this is just bleeding into that.
Well, it's been bleeding in for like the last 30
years. Yeah, so I feel like we should save a lot of this for next week, because I absolutely am right there with you, Amos. So I'm like, I want to dive way deeper into that, but we're already at a long time.
this is definitely more Hotspot talk.
I apologize. I just get really excited.
No, we all did it. It's all what we want to talk about. I mean, it is Dawn of X book chat. This is I loved this discussion, but
let's save it for next week.
Yeah.
This was fantastic. We went very off topic.
Listeners that wanted to listen to Necrozma. We did it for like 45 minutes though. We talked about that event for like 45 minutes. So we did good.
Okay. So, I think, so next week, this is our cliffhanger of me going off politically in my political beliefs. This is our cliffhanger for this episode. And next week, we will be doing House of X and Powers of X, Powers of 10. Hate the way those two are titled. And we're going to have more, it might be a longer episode just because there's so much to talk about in those two episodes. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So make sure to come visit us next week.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, come listen, guys.
Okay.
And gals and everyone in between.
So shall we sign off?
Yeah. Yeah. My name is Fox. You can find me at AgentFitz777 on Twitter.
My name is Rodders. You can find me at Rod Bunny Slay.
My name is Juan. You can find me at ChangoATX.
My name is Amos, and I'm at Unworthington on Twitter. And I'm at Diamond Gore on Art of Our Own if we're interested in that kind of stuff. So thank you all for coming, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.